this week, on the 19th of July, 1999, Egil Olsen took charge of his first game as Wimbledon manager, a pre-season friendly at Plymouth Argyle. When I left Varagria, I said I would only go to Brazil or Wimbledon. The former Norway national coach explained, it was a joke, but it had truth. Beating Brazil twice, especially in the World Cup, were my most meaningful moments in football. Brazil obviously had superior players, but Norway had a Wimbledon-style game to beat them. Yes, my friends, a Wimbledon-style. That's how you win the World Cup. Something like that, yeah? Anyhow, we're the same old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. You've been under my skin for as long as I have known. We traveled away and we stand in the rain and the cold. Take the rough with the smooth. If we win or we lose, we just go.
Hello, hello, dear listener, and welcome to the show. It's very exciting one to be here. We're recording the day after the World Cup finals has completed, and obviously there was the World Cup final last night, but we like to say that the People's World Cup was played on Saturday night. That's what we do in England. When we win something, we like to take ownership of it. So I'm delighted this week. We have got some, we've got a new guest with us today, but let me go in order. And welcome to our man with all the buttons, Dr. Adam Proctor. Hey, Adam, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. The right team won the World Cup final, which is good. So I'm happy.
That's right. We won the People's World Cup. That's true. And, our good friend, the face of all the opposition podcasts, it is Tall Mark Lewis. Hello, Mark. How are you, my friend?
Good evening. I've actually not done any opposition podcasts this season yet. However, I am scheduled to do one this week. So watch this space.
There you go.
He's still going on.
No, exactly. He says
celebrity
that
guest, mate. Celebrity guest.
He gets upset when we say it, and yet he does it all the time. So, you know, what can I say?
Someone's got to represent AFC Wimbledon in a good light, you know. And you guys are never available because you actually have lights. So.
I ain't talking no oppo fans. But our special guest today, this is very exciting because mon frère, Noel Cooper, he's not around. He's not around today. I think it's basically because his mate, who he's got his number on his phone, Mr. Burnham, is now the PM. So Niall's obviously chatting to him somewhere. But instead, we have got the man with he's lived the Wimbledon life, and I think he's been eaten and chewed out by it. But he is our man on the inside. It is the wonderful George Jones. How are you doing, George?
I'm doing well, very well. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, guys, for having me.
You're most welcome, my friend. You're most welcome. And we're
you
looking forward to hearing.
Bit, George. No one calls him Matthew.
I think they do. Or Sir, one or the other. we're looking forward to hearing all about your experiences, George. And we'll get onto that in a minute. But folks, the World Cup is over. And I genuinely felt, I know there's a sort of like all this club v country thing, but I got really invested in it towards the end, genuinely. And I genuinely thought we might actually have a chance of England winning the World Cup. So I'm still finding it quite disappointing. I wonder, why would we put ourselves through this? There's got to be reasons that we put ourselves through this because, you know, there's only a certain number of teams that can, you know, win the World Cup or win the Premier League or our division or a cup or whatever it is. Most of us are going to suffer or come out of the end of it with nothing. So why is it we do it? I guess it must be that there are moments, you know, football wise, that we do it, you know, like particular games or particular seasons. Really, on a week to week basis, why do we put ourselves through it? Mark, have you got any comment?
We meet some nice people, some nice friends, and gain sort of long, you know, friendships and allegiances and everything else through that. And I think there is definitely a feeling of belonging, because I can appreciate that obviously all of us normally on the pod, and I think George can speak for himself, had an allegiance with the actual area. I was obviously born and brought up there and lived there for like all my childhood, really. And some of us, like, I guess, whatever club you support, it's a way of connecting with your hometown, whatever your hometown was or whatever your hometown looked like. Actually, I genuinely don't know. I said this to somebody quite recently. I genuinely don't know what the millions of people who don't follow football do on a Saturday afternoon between the middle of August and the middle of April. Because I've done that, and that's all I've done, you know, basically the vast majority of my life. Certainly all of my adult life. Wouldn't know what else to do with myself, as I say.
Adam, why are you putting yourself through this?
Well, obviously, I mean, the local connection, so I'm forced to follow Wimbledon, you know, so there's that. I agree with Mark, it's this kind of connection back to a space you grew up in, for me in particular. But actually, I mean, for me, it's 90 minutes of being able to just focus on watching some other people do something, which is kick a ball around, right? And I'm not thinking about anything else. I can kind of focus. I love the competition, the jeopardy, you know, those kind of things. And I think, you know, a big part of it for me, to be fair, is hanging out with the guys that I get to sit with, you guys, etc. There's a lot of that stuff. So it's for me, it's actually a moment to turn off a lot of the thinking I have to do. And when we lose, I'm obviously pretty narked, and no one particularly likes me when I get home from a train where we've lost. But why do I come back the following week? Because we might win. And because when a goal goes in, you go mad for it. It's just exciting. You know, I don't know half of what's going on the pitch, right? But I like it. That's all that, you know, for me. And it's a moment to turn off and just hang out with people who have a collective, you know, excitement. Like that's a big thing for me. It's not just the guys I sit with, but the fact that you know that everyone walking there, everyone in the pub, etc. We all want this. At this point, we all want the same thing: have a great game of football and leave winning. And I like that has an atmosphere and a buzz that appears at like any kind of competitive sport, I suspect. But when you know that everyone has that shared connection, particularly with, you know, roots, whether that's generations, etc. You know, so. And I'm a bit, I go a bit nuts about it. And a few football friends of mine who I would say are less football mad to me don't understand how it forms such a big part of my identity, but it does, you know. So, you know, I don't quite get their following, but they can switch off a bit more than I can, whereas I certainly can't.
I think for me it's there's a hope thing as well, you know. And I think that's one thing with the World Cup was that it would have just been so nice to get over the line, because it felt like this country needed that sort of, like, you know, that thing of hope. But so does Spain, so do all these other countries. So, you know, why are we more entitled? But I mean, you know, and George, for you, what? Because not only, you know, Mark, you've been a DTB member, but you know, you've taken it to the two extremes. It's kind of, for me, it feels like it's almost part of your life.
Yeah, I think for me, a big part of it is obviously a sense of belonging, but perhaps more importantly, it's a sense of collectiveness and together, coming together and making something better than all of us as individuals. And that's one of the reasons I fell in love with Wimbledon, despite having no connections to the area. It's the sense of we all come together, and if we all come together, we can do something great. And I think that's what's great about sport, whether that's football in general and, you know, players individually coming together to achieve greatness, or at Wimbledon as a collective, fans coming together and achieving, you know, the greatest story in football. So I think it's that togetherness and that collective storytelling that to become something greater than any of us as individuals.
It's really weird, George, because it feels like you've been supporting the club for like forever. So what's your story? How did you get involved?
So I got involved. The first season I came was the Ryman Premier promotion season. That was when my dad started taking me to games. I would have been about 8 or 9 at the time. Started ball boying our first year in the Conference Premier. And yeah, for some reason, always ended up getting more and more involved and ended up getting roped into doing more and more stuff. But yeah, no, like I said, it's an incredible story. And it's always, as like I said, that collectiveness, it means everyone has to muck in. And I'm fortunate I'm in a position where I can do that. So yeah, I've been around for coming up to 20 years now, I suppose.
I mean, I always love the fact that they're, you know, there always used to be the thing about you being the first person at the ground. Is that, are you still, doing that? Because you were always like the first person there.
Yeah, but I'm, I've, because of my involvement with up until this summer, the women's team and other commitments, I've had to cut right back on away days. So sadly, that's not such a common occurrence anymore. But home games, when I was volunteering, I was always one of the first there, yeah. But again, and definitely, I remember those away days always being there ridiculously early, being at the ground at 11 o'clock before most people had left King's Cross or Euston. Some really fond memories from back then, from standing outside away ends at various northern towns.
Just waiting for the doors to open. And you would just, as soon as the doors opened, you would go in.
Yeah, just going. But again, it's that sense of collectiveness. For me, the football was about what happened as a collective and to achieve something. So all the other bits were just sort of distractions. So I was never really like, I didn't see the point of going to the pub and doing all of that. It was like, we've come here together as a collective to achieve something. And that's to enjoy the day, but also to make our club better and to win a game of football. Therefore, anything else is just a distraction.
Yeah. I love that. It's real. That is real focus. So you'd be literally at the ground 4 hours before kickoff.
Yeah. Always was, even with, you know, when I was doing stuff with the women's team, doing stuff, obviously volunteering for the men's team as well, and now at Farnham, always the first there, always making sure everything's always hyper-focused and getting every detail right. But, yeah, always been a fan of getting there early.
That's incredible. I think that we have to really get onto this. So you've obviously stopped working with our women's team, and you're now at Farnham. Is that right?
Yeah.
As it seems like half the squad and the manager.
Yeah, there's a fair few familiar faces, I think is the politest way I can describe that. But yeah, no, a lot of familiar faces down at Farnham nowadays.
And what division are they in?
So Farnham are in Tier 5 of the Women's Football Pyramid. So Wimbledon at the moment are in Tier 3, where we survived on the final day last season on goal scored. That promotion we achieved a couple of years ago was from Tier 4. So if we win the league with Farnham this year, which we're aiming to do, we will go into that league that Wimbledon won 3 years ago.
Wow. And I guess the obvious question to ask is why, George? why have you left the AFC Wimbledon's women's team?
So I think it's obviously Farnham, the project there is unbelievable. They're doing everything the right way. So they've got the owner down there is serious about the long-term sustainability of the club. He's serious about growing women's football and sees the growth and potential of that. They're putting a huge amount of resources into rebuilding their stadium and building everything the right way and being a community. Their structure as an organisation is a CIC, which is something I wish the Don's Trust would look into doing more. And I'm sure we can come on to that later, because that forces them to be a community benefit organisation and forces them to do everything the right way. And like I said, they've got real ambition and they're doing it the right way and they're putting the resources to make that happen.
What's the ownership model of Farnham? Is it owned by an individual, or is there sort of fan aspect to it?
It's owned by an individual, but the corporate structure is a CIC.
Yeah, I know, because we've had Zav on talking about being a CIC, and that potentially being a direction that the Don's Trust could move in. I'm hoping, George, is that Farnham aren't going to start stealing your heart. I mean, I'm hoping we're still going to see you down at Plough Lane.
Yeah, I mean, Wimbledon's been a huge part of my life for 20 years, and while I'm not involved with the winners' team or the Don's Trust, and I can't volunteer this season, I'm still planning on coming to games now as often as I can, and I'm sure the club will always have a big place in my heart.
Oh, this almost sounds like a transfer story. This is like, love that. Club's always going to have a big place in my heart. So, because George, you know, you were the secretary for the DTB for how many years?
So I was secretary for 2 years and assistant secretary for 1 year before that.
Okay. And that was a route you wanted to go down to rather than, you know, did you ever think about standing for the DTB itself?
I always thought about it. I always felt it was something I'd do when I'm older, because the last thing I wanted to do was to become a board member and not feel ready and not be able to give it my all. Whereas if you're going down the officer route, you're there, but you've got the support mechanism around you. And if it doesn't work out, it's easier to get the support and facilities in place to make you work there. Whereas if you're a board member and it doesn't work out, you're kind of left on your own and you have to stand down and it gets a bit messy. But yeah, so I always wanted to go into that secretariat role first and then potentially use it as a stepping stone at some point in the future.
Yeah. Okay. So, and this year you've decided to stand down as secretary for the DTB. And I think, you know, your resignation letter got out on social. So people have seen it, but for those that haven't, are you able to sort of like give us a little bit of a sense about the frustration that you felt and your reasons for standing down? Because I know it must have been really difficult, and I know that Wimbledon's in your heart and you wanted to do the best for the club. But are you able to sort of like share some of that with us?
Yeah. So that letter that went out and got shared around on socials, the main context of it is that while everyone on that board is doing what they think is right for the club and doing their very best for the club, I think there's some ways that we can improve how we operate. So I think quite often the board, through a sense of external pressure or time pressure, whatever that is, either rushes into decisions or ends up making decisions that they end up regretting, which is preventable. I think also the board worry a lot about internal politics, which is natural because the Don's Trust is a political organisation. And what they should be doing is trying to take themselves out of the internal politics and focus on making the right decisions for their club. And while I think they're always trying to do that, I think sometimes they do get sort of distracted by the internal politics and allow that to have a bigger influence on decisions than it probably should. But the main point of the letter was really to make people aware of the culture that exists. So being involved in the board, it really isn't a healthy environment. And that's been a feature of my whole 3 years, and from speaking to other people, and I don't know about whether you'd agree with this, Mark, it wasn't a healthy place for a long time before that. In terms of just not being aware of people's mental health, and in terms of making sure that it's a sustainable environment and a healthy working environment, because that's what it is at the end of the day. You know, while everyone's volunteering their time, it's important that that's a healthy and structured environment. And part of that comes from just the way the Don's Trust board operates itself, but also from the expectation of members and how members communicate with the board. Because whilst the members obviously have a key role in holding the board to account and should be critical, because that's the only way we're going to be successful is with a critical membership holding boards to account in the future, it's important that's done the right way and in a positive and healthy way, not in a toxic way, which we've seen over the last couple of years has been the case at times.
Just to quickly kind of not address George's point, but sort of just observe on that. I can't really remember how long it was, but George, my time and your time sort of overlapped a little bit, but not very much, to be fair. But equally, I think, you know, you make a fair point. when you're on a board, and I've only ever been on the board of the Don's Trust, I haven't been on the board of any other organisation, either professionally or as a volunteer. But when you're on a board in that regard, especially when you're, so to speak, almost at the whim of the reactions that people will give to, you know, 11 plus men and women running around football pitches, which in itself is a completely irregular thing, which no one actually can put any particular control on, then there are going to be some reactions which are not necessarily appropriate in terms of the methods of behaviour. I often, when I'm talking about being a football fan to friends of mine or work colleagues who are not football fans, it's kind of apparent that I think football fans themselves are a bit of a strange beast, so to speak, in that there are many, many people who are Wimbledon fans and get involved in Don's Trust, for example, or get involved in Don's Trust board. Would they automatically, instinctively be friends of each other if they met each other in the pub or on any other social occasion or work together? Sometimes I've questioned whether they would be, and so they're bound together by being on the board. And they don't necessarily, I think you make a very sensible observation there, do they necessarily therefore make as much, pay as much attention or give as much appropriate care to each other's feelings or each other's ideas or each other's personal lives? I generally don't know. I know I tried to when I was on the board, but at the same time, there were a number of occasions, and I'm sure there have been a number of occasions since I stepped down from the board, where situations occur and then you get a board meeting called, I don't know, 48 hours notice. And obviously that type of thing happens because it's a reaction to a circumstance. However, most of us know what we're doing, you know, in the next 48 hours, 72 hours, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, and so on and so forth. And we've got wives, girlfriends, friends, relations, families, and so on that get impacted by those things. And as I say, I think all the families and the appropriate loved ones of anyone who's been involved with the Don's Trust board would probably say that there wasn't necessarily appropriate care and attention given to the impact it would have on them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think James Ledward is trying to put a document together that I think would help with some of that. But being involved at board level, whether you're the secretary, treasurer, assistant secretary, or a board member, it's 365 days a year until you stop it. So, like, for example, when we won the league with the women's team at Wimbledon, a sponsor took us to Las Vegas for a week. It's a reward. And I spent that week, well, all the nights in that week, trying to work on something because there was the members' SGM called. So it's 365, you know, days a year, every year, until you stop doing it. And that's why we've gone through so many secretaries over the last few years, so many assistant secretaries over the last few years, so many board members over the last few years, because it's not sustainable, because there isn't enough care given to mental health, mental well-being. And that comes from the board needing to look after itself and not being afraid of optics all the time, and also from the members understanding that board members, officers, treasurers, they're all volunteers. They're all giving up their time for the club we love. And that means sometimes they might have to wait 3 days for a response because people are away. You know, it's important we get that right as a club, because the culture at the moment is unsustainable and not healthy whatsoever.
So George, with that in mind, I mean, I read the letter. You can tell me otherwise. I don't know how it got onto the internet necessarily, how it was leaked, I suppose is the term, or whether you put it on there, I don't know. I guess that might be semi-important to some of our listener. But also, I guess it's like, what do you think the board could do or should be doing going forward as soon as possible? Because I totally hear and have seen, people join and then they don't want to renew and all that kind of stuff. And it definitely seems to be burnout is kind of built into it, which is, you know, and you're talking directly about that. So, yeah, I wonder if you could talk about what you think some of the mechanisms might be that they should start to enact, or what you think they might be trying to do to address some of your concerns.
So I think a lot of it is there's never a good time for major change. But that's been the excuse used for our entire club's history about why we should never make a major change. I think we're at a stage now where we should be making major changes to how that operates. So for me, it was something I didn't ever discuss with the board, but I've been a long advocate of having almost running mates. So you have two people standing for every seat on the board. So for example, you and Mark could stand on a joint ticket. So one of you would be a board member, one of you would be their assistant. So if they're not around, you stand in. Because then straight away, that just doubles the number of people involved and reduces the workload for everyone massively. I spoke to certain board members around sort of at the start of this year without going into too many details about maybe bringing on someone onto the Don's Trust board as an advisor to look after mental health and well-being, just as an advisor to help us develop some sort of policies around this. I'd like to see that taken forward because I think something like that is important. Because a lot of this is incredibly serious stuff and is going to be the reason that fan ownership doesn't work in our organisation. It's because we're going to run out of people. Because we're going to have too many people burnt out and we're not going to have the next generation coming through. So I'm in my late 20s and I'm already burnt out and done with the Don's Trust pretty much. And that should be a major concern because there's no one younger than me to step up and come in. So we need to get policies and procedures in place and change that culture so it becomes attractive for young members to A, become members, and B, to get involved. So that's it's policies and procedures. It needs to be something drastic, though, because you have to be brave sometimes as an organisation, and I think we're fast approaching that point where we're not going to have a choice but to be brave.
Yeah, it's George, I think this is really interesting. I mean, because we've spoken about mental health and well-being in the past, it's partly why Niall stood down as a DTB member, and I think we've spoken to other past members, and it's why they've stood down too, because you go onto the ground, and if the club are not doing well, you become a target, rather than, you know, obviously if you're an individual owner, you can target an individual owner, and they've usually got security, or people could just drive them away, and they can go back to their big houses in the country and escape from it all. And again, if you're a manager or a player, then you're paid to do that. And, you know, unfortunately, it's part of that world. But all the people doing this work at the DTB are all volunteers. And it's frightening. I mean, I think I'm sure there had to be, or if there isn't, there must be some sort of rules of conduct for being a DTB member. So if you're a DTB member, you have to stick to, you know, the way you treat your elected officials. That needs to be part of it. And I know that there's lots of membership organisations where the members agree this sort of code of conduct, because I think it's really important. And I think the other thing that's been, in terms of making big decisions, is that when people break that code of conduct or break that trust, nothing happens to them. So, you know, you can literally go up and shout in someone's face or push them or threaten them, and the next day, the next week, they're back at the club. So, you know, there needs to be some sort of sanction, because if you are physically threatening elected officials from your club, and the next week they're back there, there needs to be something in that.
In December, we introduced a members' code of conduct, which states how we expect our members to behave. In January, I got approval for the new board members' code of conduct and how board members are expected to behave. But all of those things are only as good as the people enforcing those policies are. And again, that comes down to hoping the people who are enforcing them are willing to make the correct decisions and difficult decisions and don't worry about internal politics or making easy decisions to let people get away with stuff because it's politically convenient. It's important now that we have all of those things in place and that we hold everyone responsible, you know, to account for their behaviour and their conduct. Because at the end of the day, football is an escape. People use football to escape from their work, their 9-to-5, Monday to Friday, whatever's going on at home. Football's an escapism for everyone. And volunteers and Don's Trust board members and officers give up their escapism and it becomes draining as well. And that also leads to the burnout and contributes to it. So it's so important we get this right and get those standards, those behaviours and those cultures up to a standard which really can provide and make us become a healthy, sustainable organisation, because that's the only way we grow as a club and grow as a fan-owned club, because we can look at getting investment and stabilising the finances. What's the point of stabilising our finances at fan-owned level if we're not going to have any fans to take over and run on the Dons Trust board in 20 years?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, this is what that comes down to.
Yeah. And I think it's one thing having that sort of duty of care or that sort of like membership code of conduct, but what we also need to have alongside it is a list of penalties, because it needs to say if you break any one of these rules, this is what will happen. And maybe that isn't out, or I mean, maybe we haven't looked properly, but maybe that isn't outlined enough. It needs to say that if you break this code of conduct, this is the punishment.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, obviously the club have it where and it's available on the club website, if you do this on the stadium premises, this is the consequence. We now have our Dons Trust code of conduct where, you know, the most of the sanction could be expelled from the Dons Trust. But I'd like to see there be a lot more overlap. So if we don't think you're suitable to be a member of the Dons Trust, why are you suitable to be at the ground on a Saturday at 3 o'clock? So for me, there should be a lot more overlap, and we should be able to say to people, if you break a code of conduct for the Dons Trust, we should be able to, you know, have club consequences as well. They shouldn't be completely separate.
Yeah, I mean, listen, being expelled from the DTB it's not the biggest punishment in the world, is it? I mean, the truth is you'll probably end up paying less for your season ticket and you'll still get to go to games. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there has to be, if you break the code of the DTB, who are the owners of the club, there needs to be the punishment, which is, you know, you're either suspended from watching matches for X period of time, or if you keep doing it, you're expelled. And also there's, I think, you know, I know that there's been people who've stood for the DTB who have said some pretty vile things in the past. And it's like, you know, we're still trying to find a way for them to stand. It's like, no, I mean, if this is what's happened, maybe we need to be more transparent in what's been said, so that members get to understand why people can't stand. But yes, it needs a whole overview. And do you know what? I think I would really, I think it would be quite good, George, for you to kind of like, I'm sure you might have done this in your letter, you know, outline what needs to happen. You know, this is what actually needs to happen. And this is for your insight. You've been in the secretariat for three or four seasons now. What you've seen and what you could recommend should really be something that drives us forwards.
Yeah, but I think it's important now to, so obviously that letter's gone out and it's raised awareness of the concerns, which I think was really important, because the whole point of that was to start a discussion on what these solutions could be. Now, I have my views on what I think some of those solutions are, and I'm going to write a paper to go to the board that will help, you know, inform them on my views. But also, my views shouldn't impact what anyone else's views on it are. I've raised the issue of these are the problems as I see them. Who's got an idea? Because my solutions might not be the best ones. So the more people we have contributing to this discussion, contributing to this debate, is only going to make us healthier as an organisation, because then it means we will find the best solutions. Because there might be a good one that I haven't thought of. So I'd encourage everyone to have a think about it and get involved, because I think we're at a stage now where there are some problems within our organisation that we need to improve for the long-term future. And every voice is a good voice to get involved, and I'd encourage absolutely everyone to get involved.
Yeah.
So, George, with that in mind, you talked about the fact that, you know, you burnt out, people are burnt out, we're going to run out of people to actually stand, and that's going to really get in the way of us continue to be fan-owned. I mean, again, I don't know how much you can talk about this necessarily, but obviously there was the attempt to use Discord to kind of onboard more younger fans. That seemed to be part of the motivation, right? And I understand that, because loads of the students I engage with in the gaming communities, etc., they all use Discord, and they are generally a younger demographic in those spaces. But what we saw, and I was on there quite a bit, was that it was the same old people on on Discord. It didn't seem to necessarily attract more younger people into the space to have those conversations. And then, of course, it's been shut down and replaced with a WhatsApp channel, which did something really weird in the last week or so. Not the Don's Trust one, the official AFC Wimbledon one, sort of suddenly became not available in this country and then came back, which was a bit strange. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about that attempt to try and onboard more young fans to get involved. Because obviously the first step to thinking about being a Don's Trust board member is just to generally be involved in the conversations. And that we didn't really see that happening in that space where I think it was hoped to happen.
Yeah, so the Discord was set up by myself and Rhys Wheeler-Curley, who was the assistant secretary at the time. He's since left as well. But the whole point was to get younger members involved and get them involved in that conversation and start engaging them in that conversation with the hope of they become engaged members and then potentially stand for election in the future. I think the Discord, we did see several younger members and several new faces pop up on there. But very quickly, it got took over by the same old loud voices we saw on pro boards. And for, I've forgotten the name of the one that was on the platform before pro boards. Webjam. But it's so important when we have these young faces, when we have these new voices come in, they don't get shouted down, they don't get treated in a condescending way. Because without being funny, seeing the way some of them were treated on Discord, if that was me as a younger, newer fan, I wouldn't get involved. I'd leave the Discord, I'd leave the Don's Trust. It's clearly not for me. And I think it's so important that, you know, and it's in the election report that Ed Mayo published into the Don's Trust election. We've got a huge number of long-standing fans without whom the club wouldn't exist. But it's so important we get that new generation going and get them involved. And that means this new generation, the older generation, has to be accommodating, welcoming and positive towards these new fans, even if they don't agree with them on everything. Because it's so important to get that new generation involved, because otherwise fan ownership dies out with that generation. And we can't let that happen.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I think it's really important to be able to create safe spaces for different groups of different people in different ways. And that's disappointing to hear. And I saw bits of it on the Discord myself and certainly felt that there was unnecessary comments, etc., that would put people off. I do wonder whether, I know we have obviously some of the spaces at the stadium where there's activities for much younger kind of kids to get involved with. But I wonder if there's spaces and places we could create where it's, again, you know, a safer space for different demographics to have those conversations and not feel that their voice isn't being heard, you know, and maybe ensuring that the criteria might be, but do you know what I mean? There's somewhere where someone who maybe can connect between those generations or connect between the pieces who's up for listening and up for having those conversations, whether there are other spaces on the, you know, in the state, you know, you talked about getting there really early. I suspect if there's something for people to do, they'd want to do that. So I wonder if there's some physical spaces that might accommodate that kind of conversation.
Yeah, but also we mustn't forget that, you know, we've got 7,500 members from all over the world. We shouldn't limit ourselves to just things that can be done in person at the ground on a Saturday at midday. We should be doing more to get them engaged and create that safe space. But that should be virtual because that's where this generation is. So one of the things that I did in my time is we set up a youth engagement advisory board, which was full of members under 30. And we actually got a lot of really good output from that group. They gave us a lot of really encouraging feedback, a couple of really good ideas. And they gave us a lot of positive information that we were then able to take into that 50.1 campaign, which we managed to get passed. But we're in a position now where obviously that sort of fell away a little bit as the time commitment around that 50.1 sort of became more and more extreme. But stuff like that is so important to have those environments where it is exclusively that group. So that underrepresented group, whether that's women, whether that's young people, whether it's people from different backgrounds, all of these things, we should be doing whatever we can to get them in a room together and speaking, because they're never going to try and get in a shouting match with some of our fans who have been around for 50 years and don't like change. So we need to go to them and we need to get them in an environment where they're comfortable and they feel safe and we can get them on board, because they're the ones who we're going to need to replace the current generation of older members. And it's important older members understand that and accept that. But at the same time, we need to make this a welcoming, safe environment. And like I said in that open letter, at the moment, we are not a welcoming environment for young fans or fans from different backgrounds or female fans. in terms of some of the culture elements we have in as an organisation. And that's something we've got to change quickly, but the only way we can change that is by getting them involved. So it was that last thing that I included in the letter was pleading everyone from those different backgrounds to get involved, whether that's formally getting involved in some way or forming pressure groups, because that's what we need now. We need that younger generation and those people from different backgrounds to stand up and make sure their voices are heard.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it was one of these things that, you know, you're actually, and maybe this gets complicated, but I like that idea of kind of like a two people ticket thing, you know, like you've got the member in this, but maybe you also have, maybe within that ticket, you also have like a young person as well who can be, you know, mentored by a DTB member and can offer some sort of support and ideas. So it'd be quite nice if you have this sort of like, you know, maybe the board shrinks and you have three people for each role, someone who can step in, but you've also got a younger person who can sort of like see what it's like and could be mentored by the elected DTB official, or you have a separate young people's DTB which is properly facilitated by so it needs something like that. And you know you're right, I mean, at the moment there's real lack of diversity at the top, and I think a lot of it is because there's a huge amount of demand, so a lot of people can't commit that sort of time to it. And also, like you say, George, it just feels really, it feels quite toxic, and I think what I'm really worried about, what terrifies me, is that not only have the DTB lost you and Reese, not only have they lost that, but I fear that as a football club, we've lost you as a supporter, because you're now going to be spending time at Farnham and getting involved in all of what's going there. And it sounds like a really exciting project, but we're losing you as a fan, which I find incredibly upsetting. So it feels like anyone who's gone through this process, whether they've been a secretary or a DTB member, has come away feeling slightly scarred. And that really hurts.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for you, Mark, but I think we both, you know, you'd lose count on the number of people who've been involved at board level who have either stopped coming to games completely or massively reduced their involvement in other areas of the club. And that's something we have to fix, because being a board member or an officer or something should be an add-on. And when you step away from it, it shouldn't have impacted your time at the club. You should still love that club the same as you always have. My love for the club has definitely decreased over the last 3 to 5 years just because of my involvement with it and the drain that it's put on me. And that's something we have to fix, because, again, that's not a sign of a healthy culture. And it's something we have to get right. And it's something that is so, it's why, like I said, there's never a good time to make good changes, to make big changes, sorry. There's always a reason to delay them or to kick the can down the road or to not want to do it, because there's always a crisis. There's always a fire to put out. We're at a stage now where I think we really have to start making those big, difficult structural decisions to allow us to make sure that this is a healthy organisation going forward. To make sure that you don't have burnout, the fact you stop losing volunteers, the fact that you should. I think if you spoke to every board member, most of them would say they love the club less than they did when they started. And that's something that shouldn't happen. And we need to make sure that stops happening, because that's how you lose fans. And that's why you don't have younger members getting involved. And that's what we have to fix.
I'm almost a couple of years away from being on the board. I talked about stepping down earlier on. I didn't actually step down. I chose not to stand. But actually, the reason that I chose not to stand was primarily actually down to my own personal and work commitments. At the time when I went on the board, I had a relatively low-key job, without being rude to that company that I used to work for. And I had some time on my hands, and I both mentally as well as just sort of, so to speak, emotionally, I had more time to be able to commit. And then in the time that I was on the board, my role changed. I went to a different company. I was being paid a lot more money, and I was responsible for a lot more things. And now I've got a different job entirely a few years down the line. And again, would have, I've got a lot more international element to my job, so that wouldn't really facilitate doing this type of thing. Would I agree with George's comment there about loving the club less? Possibly not. But again, I think it depends on, you know, the particular personal experiences people have. What I think I am aware of is that a lot of people have been on the board and are still on the board now, end up sort of engaging with themselves, and they don't want to be a clique, and they don't want to turn into a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of, I only talk to these people, I only listen to these people, this is the only view I have. But almost inevitably, sometimes they do. I do remember, for example, traveling back a number of times, not last season, but the season before, a couple of years before that, from long away trips to, you know, Plymouth and some trips up north, obviously a lot of northwestern trips, where, you know, conversations would happen, which would be, oh, let's talk to someone from the Don Trust board. And someone like Graham Price, who is fabulous, because he's quite happy to talk to anyone, and it doesn't matter who they are. And whether even board members like that, I don't know. I certainly used to get quite frustrated, if I'm being completely honest, with fans, because fans would assume that because I was on the board, therefore I was going to act in a certain way or respond in a certain way or toe a party line or whatever, whereas I was actually just interested in talking to anyone and everybody. But when I had the audacity to suggest that, I was on social media, for example, then that didn't really go down the way I was intending it to at all, and people thought I was being quite aggressive. So that was a lesson for me to learn overall. I would say that George is right, though, that, you know, everyone needs to be open to the views of different people and different opinions. I know, for example, that my two 19-year-olds read the AFC Wimbledon Reddit pages quite a lot and quote them to me quite a lot. Now, I've never read any of them, but they do find them quite amusing, and they actually, from what I can see, they troll away fans after we've beaten them, but that's just what 19-year-olds do, I suppose. But I do similar things on the BBC website comment page as well, so each to their own. But I think, you know, some of the things with regards to youth, that has been involved, that has been engaging on and off for some time, even back to when I was on the board, because I remember sitting in on a sort of smaller youth group, and one of the suggestions that was made there was, why don't we have a happy hour? Which seemed like a complete no-brainer. And that word obviously then spread its way through to the club. I don't know how long it took, but it was introduced as a beginning of last season, I think it was, as a sort of temporary measure, let's see how it goes, and then it became a standard thing to do. And I suspect the club, if pressed on what the actual numbers were in terms of the revenue, you'd like to hope that actually the revenue itself from bar sales and so on increased overall. Certainly the crowds held up rather well. What I think is actually as important, picking up on George's point about fresh blood, getting fresh people involved. Having been to women's games, there are times when I've been to women's games at Plough Lane. I haven't been to any other games, I must admit, which is my bad. But when I've been to women's games at Plough Lane, they've often been quite an antidote to the way the men were playing, because it's a different crowd, it's a different crack, there's a different demographic. There are people who don't go to men's games, as far as I can see. A lot of people I didn't recognise, which is really good, actually. Some go to both, but a lot of people only go to the women's games. And obviously the way that the players interacted. And I'd like to hope that with the new management and the new players, obviously I know George is involved in that, but new management and new players would still continue to do that type of thing with post-match engagement and signing and so on. Engaging that crowd and also engaging however many new season ticket holders we've got at Plough Lane, because we know that quite a few of those who've now been going 4 or 5 years or so, who won't have the built-in Kings Meadow, let alone original Plough Lane memories. In memory bank, engaging those people, understanding what opportunities there are with those people. If they've got younger children, that's not going to work necessarily quite so well. But if perhaps those children are growing up and they've got an opportunity to be involved on a volunteer basis, that would be a sensible move forward, I think.
Mark, I agree. I think that is a thing. But I think the big warning from George on this is that if we engage people, and get them along to it. So you can be part of a fan-owned club. You can give its direction. And then we don't protect them. We don't give them that mental health support. And we don't... And we allow them to be abused by fans.
Yeah, I was going to say, Matthew, or abused by the process, right? Some of it, I think, is also abused by the process, because it's really tricky to do this thing. Like George says, you know, he's in Las Vegas having to work on things. There's board meetings called in 48 hours. I mean, that is not acceptable for any organisation, actually, particularly a volunteer. And I think you're right. It starts for me with one of the bits where it's like, it's about agency, isn't it, right? One of the things that we love about fan ownership is we feel there is some agency, and I still feel there is. And a big thing that we do at work is like a you said, we did, right? So if you've got young fans who feel they've got some agency, so like Mark says, they said, we like a happy hour, you said, we did. You know, there's probably many other things that they would want. But then, like you say, that agency and advocacy for what they would like to see happening around the club is great, but not if they then get to a point where they really want to get involved and then the place that they go to is inaccessible, which is basically, I think, a lot of what George is talking about, is inaccessible because of the kind of lifestyle that you might have to have outside or, you know, of work. Like Mark said, I could do it during this particular period of time. I thought there's a period of time where I might be able to do it. Again, I've said I can't, you know, but I'm also thinking, wow, I dodged a bullet there, because that might have been a couple of years of quite intense stress that would have been, you know, not so useful. So, yeah, I think it's a combination of those pieces. But I totally agree. We can't, if we want to get people involved and we get them to feel they've got some agency and they can advocate for their space, the what they want, and yet if they can't, then move into places where they then get, yeah, whether that's abuse from other fans or abuse from processes, that's terrible.
Yeah, one of the things I think really needs to be looked at is, I think that all DTB members, I think they should be able to have access to a director's seat, to a director's box, or whatever it is, because there was times where I know DTB members were getting abuse within where they were sitting, and they didn't feel safe about being there. So I think that is wrong. So you can choose to have your seat, but if you feel that you are being threatened or abused, you should be able to have access to a director seat. I think is a really, really is a simple win. But George, I mean, I'm interested in when you put your paper together, we'll promote that. I mean, and I'm pretty sure there'll be things in there that we would agree with. And we've often put our own thoughts together about the structure of the DTB and how it needs to change. But time and time again, mental health just comes up all the time. And the role of the DTB was always to sort of like hold the PLC to account, really, and to make sure that's going. That's what it should be. It shouldn't be an all-consuming thing. And I'm quite interested, we've heard from Zab a bit about this, but the idea of the DTB becoming a community interest company, a CIC. What's your thoughts behind that, George?
So I think, obviously, it was in the published minute that Zav came and did a presentation on it, and I know he's spoken to you guys about it. I think there's a huge amount of positive work that can be done through becoming a CIC, and I know there's a lot of other sort of smaller benefits that come potentially as well. But for me, it all sets out and comes back to, what do we want to be as an organisation? We should be an organisation that always tries to do the right thing, be community-based, do the right thing ethically, and do all of those good things. Being a CIC forces us to do it. But for me, I think it's important to not think that becoming a CIC solves all of our problems, because it really doesn't. No. It's a small piece in a much, much bigger puzzle that we have to sort out. And it's important that, again, because you're looking at, and I can see one of the problems being that, you know, we've got the investment ongoing at the moment, you potentially sort that out, then you potentially look at becoming a CIC, and you do all of these things. And then all of a sudden, you're 3 years down the road and you haven't made any actual changes to the day-to-day operations because you're focusing on the big stuff. This is something where we have to be able to get these things going alongside these projects. We have to be able to do simultaneous projects and get these things going in a way that means we can make massive changes quickly.
Yeah.
While I think a CIC definitely has its benefits, it doesn't solve all our problems. It's definitely worth exploring. I know the board are doing work into it at the moment, so I don't really want to talk too much about it specifically. But yeah, I think it could be a potentially a good thing.
And you know what I think I'd like to call for is a members conference or event where we could address, look at the issues and have little working parties at that day where we could all explore issues about ways that things could be fixed. Because I think there are so many people out there who have really great experience of working within organisations that if you got a whole of us together, you know, 200, 300 people together in a room, you had these sort of like little workshops and things like that. At the end of it, you could come up with a really good way forwards on particular issues, and each thing you could address a certain thing. The mental health and well-being, finance, all this, like the progression of the club, you know, how you look after your members, all of these sort of things that could be addressed if we had a sort of like a large event. Because you're right, George, you know, I think you've got a lot of great answers. And I think between us all, we've all got some other answers and opinions as well. And there are other people out there who would. So I think if we could get people together in a room, use those skills and expertise, you could come up with a really great solution and use your model, Adam, of like, you know, you said we did sort of thing. And I think that could, you know, we could change it. This is a time, and you know, we could spend a whole lot of time saying it's not the right time, or we haven't got the right thing, or we can't do this, or we can't, but we need to, you know, otherwise it's going to keep happening. I mean,
again, I was going to say, Matthew, on some of that stuff is again, that, you know, and I talked a bit about this in some of my manifestos about looking at some of the movements around open source, you know, and a lot of things they do, like Mozilla used to have a festival where they bring the community together and they thrash through some ideas around the kind of things they wanted to solve in the Mozilla Foundation. And a bunch of other open source people do that, and they have these little festivals. So a Don's Trust Festival, where we get people together to talk through the kind of the knotty things that we want to achieve over the next 12 months, etc., with people that are invested, who are not board, they're not board members, but they are members. I mean, I definitely, if there was a whole day at Plough Lane, round table events, I'd definitely tip up and try and help make things better. And I'm pretty confident a lot of other people would do. And I think if you spun it in the right way, you could definitely get a bunch of young people to engage with that. And of course, you could have a blended scenario where appropriate as well, so that we can, you know, invite those international fans, etc. But yeah, I think, I mean, we know that the Don's Trust board often listen to the podcast. So I think we are definitely pitching some sort of Don's Trust festival, unconference, like thing would be amazing.
Yeah, DTB, you give us a date, you give us a space, we'll make it happen.
Not the Matt Gibb is an event organizer at all, but yeah.
No, you let it happen. And do you know what? This is my big thing, George. This is my big thing. It's going through that. I want to make that happen. I want that day to happen. I'm getting you back, mate. I'm getting you back.
Yeah.
You're only on loan at Farnham. And to be honest with you, at some point you're going to realise you've made it, you know, like, I get it. Have a step away. You're going to realise where your home is. Do you know what I'm saying?
What you're really saying is that George Jones is the new James Tilley.
Yeah. He's going to go away. He's going to enjoy it, but then there's going to be something nibbling at him.
To a board member about bringing on someone to, you know, effectively be responsible for the mental and health and well-being to the board, and they were worried about the external optics of that and what fans would think and what members would think. And for me, we need a board to be brave enough to say, you know, it doesn't really matter about optics, we think we should be doing better at this, we could be better at this, let's ask for help. In the same way, because I think that's a really healthy attitude in life. If you are not doing great at something, you should be able to ask for help. And that's what I hope the board can do, is put their hand up and say, we could be better at this. Who's got an idea? Who's got a suggestion? It doesn't matter what people think. It doesn't matter if members think less of us as an organisation, because we're going to do the right thing for the organisation, even if that means some short-term dodgy messages on various message boards because people don't like it. So that would be my hope, that the board can be brave enough to start making decisions like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an excellent call, and I'm really pleased that Adam, you had that idea for a big event. it sounded like my voice. It was a really weird thing, but you know, it's cool. It's fine, George. No, it's fine, George.
That's you just keep it out.
It's a collective endeavour. This is all we've been talking about. It's not one person. It's not about one person.
So here's a question.
We're thrashing out great ideas.
Who here went to the Sutton game on Saturday?
Not me.
I know George didn't go.
Tumbleweed. Yeah, no, neither did I. In fact, I chose not to go. I went to a comedy gig in the afternoon instead. So no one's been to anything pre-season yet.
No one's been to anything pre-season. And so this is what we know. And George, you're going to have to bear with us now because we're going to talk Wimbledon. And you know what? I'm not even going to let you go. You've got to be here. So it's exciting.
He hasn't said he's not Wimbledon.
Yeah, no.
He
hasn't talked
to us about Farnham Town's men's team signings yet.
Shush your noise. It's not allowed to happen. No, talking about oppositions, Mark. You can save that for your Oppo podcast. I mean, it's been interesting. I think the big things over the summer is Seddon's come back only on a 1 year, and Tilly has come back on a 3 year thing on an undisclosed, which is really interesting. I don't think we've ever given out 3 year contracts. And then you know we've got some people who've signed professional contracts: Sam Gomer, Harry Hedges, and Joe Kirby. Now, George, I know you've been interested in the academy in the past. What have you seen any of these guys play? Has anyone seen any of these guys play? Harry Hedges seems to be knocking some goals in. Do you know anything about any of them, George?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, Harry Hedges has had a really good start in pre-season. He's got a couple of goals. The people who have been at the pre-season game so far have been really impressed and said he's the standout. He was always sort of one player who I've heard really positive things about in the academy. But the one I'm really excited about is Sam Gomer, the defender. Oh. Everyone I've spoken to who knows what they're talking about at that level has really, really rated him. So I'm really encouraged to see him get that opportunity. He is a defender, which does mean he is going to be, you know, an extra 2 or 3 years in development before breaking in. He's not going to be one of those breaking straight into the first team like an attacker would be. But he's one with, I think, a really high ceiling. We've obviously seen the two boys go out to Premier League clubs now as well from that age group. But yeah, so a couple of really good young players. Hopefully they'll be breaking through over the next couple of years. And I hope they get the opportunity. Is there something that maybe Johnny hasn't been able to do in the last few years? We haven't seen those young players be given the opportunity. So hopefully now we're in League One and, you know, hopefully we're doing okay, you can start blooding some of them in a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I'm interested in what happens with Junior Nkeng over the next season. And I'm not around to there's the Meet the Manager event coming up soon, isn't there? When's that again? Is that the 4th of August, something like that? And yeah, so I'm kind of keen to, the question I would like to ask is, when does Junior Nkeng's contract run to? Because I think if you ask how long his contract is, the people say 2 years, but it could end any time. But I want to know when it runs to.
The question I'd like to ask is, have we got a better idea as to how we can actually maximise the impact that that kind of player has by not playing wing-back? Because just talking football for a minute, you've got Tilly back.
Yep.
They've obviously signed Cessignon, who I believe is a right-back. And in fact, Jackson talked about him playing in his right position, which indicates perhaps when he played at Wigan, he wasn't played in his correct position. You've naturally also still got Seddon to play left. What is interesting is that so far it appears in the preseason games, Seddon's been primarily playing left-sided centre-back because we don't actually have enough centre-backs because Lewis has left as far as we can see. And we've played 3 preseason games now without Lewis. Nothing's been said. Nothing's been mentioned, and he hasn't also signed for another club, or if he has, that hasn't been mentioned either, which is rather bizarre, because in simple terms, we start paying him at the end of June, so either he's rich enough to go without a month's wages, or something strange going on there. Anyway, we've been playing, I read somewhere, people like Kai Jennings at wing-back. Now, that doesn't really make any sense, because I'm sure he could do a job, and I'm sure if you said to young people like Jennings or Hedges, we need you to play wing back, they'll say yes, of course, because they want to make an impression. But they're not wing backs. We've got enough wing backs, but at the moment we've only got Ryan Johnson, and so I'm going to forget already. In terms of centre backs, we've only got Johnson and how many are we?
We've got Johnson, Sweeney, and Oggs.
Yeah. Johnson, Sweeney, and Oggs. They probably would be our first choice back three. And the interview that Craig Cope did, I thought, from the Spanish shore was quite interesting and revealing, without saying very much, because he's very good at that type of thing. And he talked about another four or five players signing, and since then we've only signed Tilly. So you'd like to hope there's another four players signing. So far, Stevens has been injured and not played anything pre-season at all. We haven't replaced Lewis, we haven't replaced Boogle. At the very least, we need to replace those two, and you'd like to hope that we've got something wages-wise to do that. But equally, centre-backs-wise, last season, we had Lewis playing a considerable amount and Barrett playing a considerable amount and Oggs and Johnson. And Seddon actually, towards the end of the season, played wing-back. Played left-sided centre-back, not wing-back. So actually, we need another couple of centre-backs, I think, at the very least, as well as midfield looks all right, actually. Midfield seems to be the one position we've got some strength and depth, but naturally enough, for Adam's benefit, if no one else is, we need to replace somebody else so that Adam can become the CEO and president of the new players fan club, whoever that new player out front may be.
You never know. There's going to be someone. I'm going to have a favourite. Let's just hope they stay for as long as Omar.
Talking of favourites, Adam, you've got the new shirts. What's the skinny on the new shirts?
I do like the white one a lot, I have to admit.
Is it really white?
Yeah.
I don't know what they call it, but it looks white.
Is it cream? No, I thought it was a kind of off-white.
I mean, I wore it when it was a very sunny day, blinding everyone down the street, so it seemed pretty white to me. But yeah, no, I like that one. The red one's really cool as well. I haven't worn the blue one yet. They've got different colours on each one. So that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure I like the collar shape for the home kit, but I'll see when I wear it. Really, I did like the white one because it's just a simple round collar. So, but they're all really cool, and they look better in person than on the pictures. And you don't have to be really moody to wear the white one; you can just be happy. You know, unlike the photo shoot where...
Oh, I thought that was a thing.
No,
I thought
it was a it's thing. Fine.
And also, you don't have to shop in IKEA to wear the home kit.
No, that's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, some people have been complaining about that looking like a Greggs like or something like IKEA. But I don't mind the design. I'm just not sure about the shape. So, I'll wear that to the first home game because it's a home top.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. We're coming up. We're not that far away, are we? The 8th of August is our first home game. And we've got a friendly this Wednesday against Norwich, which you can get down to Plan A, but you could also watch it on Don's TV. I think you have to pay a fiver to watch that, if you so wish. I know George will be watching it. Oh, mate.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to make the first few preseason games this year, sadly.
No, I know. You know, we're getting you back. And talking of TV, I see Sky have meddled with our fixtures already. So our first... the first one is the game against Bromley, and I can't remember if that's a home or away game. I think it might be away, and it's now going to be on Monday, the 7th of September, and the game against Franchise is now going to be on Thursday, the 17th of September.
Yeah, Thursday night, that well-known night for playing football.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to play Franchise. We want to excommunicate them off the face of the earth.
Yeah,
but playing on a Thursday, I mean, really.
I know.
I mean, it's actually going to get some proper attention from media because that early in the season, there probably won't be too many European games, if any. Yeah. So actually, you're going to get some mainstream people sent to it. And if Franchise are talking the way that they are, then they may well have a decent squad as well.
Yeah. And finally, on this, because we've been going on for a while now... because we're so excited, George, you've been brilliant, mate. But I was watching, I was on socials, and then someone put up this thing about the Sunday brunch. And there was an interview with an actress there, and she talked about this new AFC Wimbledon film that she might be involved in called Plough Lane. And there was a director attached to it and a writer, and it seems like it's... maybe ready to go maybe ready for development, which sounds incredibly exciting. I mean, but it was really weird that it was announced there on on Sunday brunch, and I've not heard anything about it since. It's not on.
Think she like jumped the gun possibly?
I think maybe she did. But it's not been on socials. It's not been on the website. It's like nobody knows about it apart from the little grin I can see on George Jones' face. You know.
Dear listener, George has put his finger over his lips to indicate that he clearly knows and he can't tell me.
Well, the interviewers must have prepped because they asked the specific questions, didn't they? Because then he said AFC Bournemouth to begin with, like a fool. I mean, I've never even heard of that TV show.
He corrected himself very quickly. But
they were obviously briefed, though, because they wouldn't have asked that question, would they? So,
it was Tim Lovejoy who knows nothing about anything. And hasn't done since he was on Soko AM, you know.
It's interesting. So there does seem to be some movement on that, which would be quite interesting. And obviously, you know, if anyone wants help with the script, I mean, if I knew someone had written a script before, then they can come and talk to that person.
I just want someone to sneak me part three, the video of part three that we've never got to see. Surely it's got to be on the Pirate Bay or wherever, somewhere.
Well, that was actually mentioned at some point in passing as well with, I forget the name of the organisation, but there's an organisation that has been filming and was filming last year as well. And they were mentioned pre-season because I think they've come on board as one of the club sponsors. And it was mentioned that they are helping out with regards to, it's the sponsors of the third kit, I believe, or at least an organisation associated with the sponsors of the third kit. Yeah, so that's the organisation, but they've got either a branch of their company or a company that work with them that have produced documentaries overall commercially, and they're working with us in terms of documentary production. So whether that means that they've been able to offset the cost of the production of the documentary against the sponsorship, who knows?
Interesting. Hey, we're the Dons. We're going to be all over the screens and telling the wonderful story that is of AFC Wimbledon. Yes! There are some kinks we need to sort out in our structure work things. But, you know, together, if we all come together and we all point ourselves in the right direction, treat each other with respect, we can do amazing, wonderful things. Now, my friends, that is it. It's been the Same Wild Wombles Summer Special Mark II. Thank you very much to Dr. Adam Proctor, to Tall Mark Lewis, with all of his info and knowledge, and for the insight knowledge, we are getting him back. It is the brilliant George Jones. Thank you, George, very much.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Cooper. We're the Same Old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. You've been under my skin for as long as I have known. Traveled away and we stand in the rain and the cold. Take the rough with the smooth.